Okay, so based on what we've talked about, the recommended motion from staff, oh, it's on the board now. Everybody can see it on the Zoom. But it authorized the executive director and the board chair, conditioned upon their approval of satisfactory diligence, to approve the terms of the mediated settlement agreement with Lone Star Investment Advisors and its affiliates, and authorized the executive director to approve up to $16 million of funding in senior secured notes to Lone Star Investment Advisor funds to cover obligations, including settlement costs, working capital needs, follow-on investments, and other fund obligations. So I will move that motion. Do we have a second for that?
Tina, second.
Any further discussion? Anybody opposed to this motion? Okay. Doesn't seem like any opposed, so it's unanimous, all 11 in favor. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We will keep you apprised as we move forward. This is a conditional approval, as noted, and as we do more due diligence and look at things, we'll be back and report. We'll have Kent report back to the entire board as we are making progress with either positive or negative progress on this. Okay, so with that, we can now go back. We'll stay. I think we should stay in open session for the public. How many people do we have from the public on there, John?
We've got about 10.
Okay. Let's continue with these next two items, which are in open session, and then we'll go back for the legal issues back to closed session. So we're gonna, next, I think, is the fixed income review.
That's correct. So I'll turn it over to Mike here shortly. Mike is on the investment team, been with us a little over a year, does a fantastic job covering fixed income. He's going to be going through our managers, you know, and trying to give you a taste for all of them. And I just kind of add the qualifier that it's always frustrating, especially those who are long-term investors, to kind of this level of detail. So any extra detail you want, we're always at, you know, let us know and we can have further conversations. We know these, Mike knows these managers inside and out. So, Mike, over to you.
Mike, could you give us a page reference on it so we can get back there?
58.
Thank you.
All right, hi, everybody. It's Mike. As Kent said, I'm going to try to go through this pretty high level, just in the interest of time, but if you guys have any detailed questions, happy to answer them if you ask us. But if we'll be on 558, if we're looking at, because we've looked at this earlier with Kent on the asset allocation, but what you'll see here is that at the top, we have our current asset allocation, and then the bottom is that stressed private market write-down asset allocation. The first column is going to be the current allocation. Second column is our target, and the third is the variance. A couple of key points I want to hit here is if you look at the safety reserve cash, it's at $92 million. That's overweight currently, but we expect that to be underweight by the end of the year just due to cash flow needs that we'll have. Investment-grade bonds, if you look at that row, we're currently underweight a little bit. We just funded a active manager there, which we'll talk about later, from our previous passive Vanguard investment. But that is underway right now, and we will bring that up to target once we have the cash to deploy. Another asset class that we'll take a look at right now is emerging market debt. So that is underway about 3% to target, and that is by design, due to our implementation plan, that should be filled up after equities are brought up to target. And then everything else is pretty much at target. We did a little bit of rebalancing in August So safety reserve, that line is at target. It's probably the biggest portion of the fixed income allocation. And then everything else is, I guess, global bonds, bank loans, high yield. They're all targeted at 4%, and we're basically at that target. John, can we go to the next slide, 59? Great. So I'm going to go over some milestones in the fixed income portfolio. To start with our short-term investment grade allocation, that is with Income Research. So we initially funded that in 2016 with $50 million. And then in 2018, we increased that allocation up to 15% of the entire BPFP portfolio and funded IRM with that. $198 million. In addition to that, we have our investment grade core allocation, which we added a 4% allocation to that in the portfolio in 2018. We funded initially a Vanguard passive investment in September 2019 and then a follow-on investment in January 2020. And then in July of 2020 this year, we redeemed from that Vanguard investment and moved all that money to Longfellow Investment Management into an active investment grade core investment manager. Next, I want to touch on bank loans. So previously, we had two bank loan managers, Luma Sales and Pacific Asset. In February 2020, we redeemed from Loomis, which was the riskier bank loan manager, and moved it into Pacific, which is our more conservative bank loan manager. So that timing helped us out right before the downturn. And now Pacific is the sole bank loan manager sitting at 4% of target. And then this year we did some rebalancing in 2020. In Q1 and Q2, this year, we redeemed some IRM, $40 million in total for cash flow needs. And then in August, we rebalanced some of those credit sectors back to their allocation, given the write-downs in the private market. John, can we go to the next page? Great. So this chart is going to show us the performance of the portfolios and some characteristics of our portfolio. So the top chart shows us performance of DPFP and then performance of DPFP without IRM included, and then the performance of our benchmark, which is the Barclays multi-versatile return. The key points I want to note here are that you can see that the DPFP portfolio has been actually helped out by the large allocation to IRM. And then also, I guess, recent performance for DPFP's fixed income portfolio has trailed the benchmark. And both of those are attributed to the fact that we've had some poor performance in some of these riskier fixed income allocations, specifically global bonds, high yield, and emerging market debt, which we'll dig into in more depth in the following slides. This bottom chart shows us our portfolio metrics, and you can see that we've got each manager in the column going from short-term investment grade on the left, and it just moves, I guess, riskier as it moves to the right, all the way to EM debt, and then the last column is DPFP as the entire portfolio. And so we have metrics here that show yield to maturity, the average quality, weighted average maturity, and the average duration. You can see that yield to maturity increases as we move left to right. The average quality decreases as we move left to right. And duration increases from left to right, with the exception of Pacific Asset. It's a bank loan investment, which is floating rate, so the duration could be very minimal. And then if we look at these 3 and 5 year metrics, the key points here are that for some of these more troubled allocations being in global bonds, high yield, and EM debt, the standard deviation is much higher for those. And if you look at the information ratio, they are negative for the 3 year. And that basically states that negative information ratio states that the excess returns are going to be negative. You want to be on the next slide? So this slide here shows us it's a summary of all of our investment manager performance. I'm not going to go into too much detail on this slide because all these performance metrics will be on the individual manager review slides. But the key point to note here is that if you're looking at this, we have certain years in italics, and that's just those will be the composite returns. That's our inception date from our fund with that manager did not go back that far. But we can also note here that you can see the negative excess returns for Brandywine, Loomis, and Ashmore, which are the global bond, high yield, and EM debt. John, you go to the next slide. Before I get into every manager here, I just want to lay out how the slides are laid out. So each manager is going to be the same layout. I guess at the top, the first slide is going to have our current market value as of August, the inception date, and then our benchmark, and then it'll lay into the philosophy, process, and the organization. And then the following slide will be, it'll have performance and risk metrics at the top with some commentary on the performance. With that said, we'll dig into the first one. It's income research and management. They are our short-term investment grade allocation, designed to be very safe and stable, basically just invest in investment grade rated bonds with shorter maturities. You can see that these, that IRM makes up $216 million of our entire fixed income portfolio. So by far the largest. Some key points for IRM is that they are duration neutral. The strategy tends to overweight spread sectors, so corporate and securitized, and underweight U.S. trade. John, go to the next slide. So here we see the performance of IRM and some risk metrics. What I'd like to note is for this asset class, the volatility is lower. You can see that in the top right of the slide. The long-term performance has tended to outperform the benchmark. And that's really due to the overweight in spread sectors, which is what we expect. And then we would also expect for the performance to modestly underperform when markets are in risk off. We've seen this in 2020. For example, in Q1 of 2020, you see this max drawdown chart up in the top right. Income research drew down 1.12%, whereas our benchmark didn't draw down at all. But IRM, they kept with their philosophy and their positioning, and they outperformed throughout the recovery in Q2 and Q3. So this has been consistent with what our expectations are of them. John, do you have the next slide? And so our next manager is Longfellow. They are our investment grade core manager. It's very similar to IRM. The only difference is the asset class is going to have long maturities. So like I mentioned, we funded Longfellow in July 2020 with $60.5 million. Some of the key points of this strategy They take a defensive in nature philosophy, and they tend to diversify for risk mitigation, so they're very concerned with protecting on the downside. Their goal is to provide some attractive risk-adjusted returns, but maintaining low tracking error and volatility. One of the advantages of Longfellow is that since they are smaller in size, they try to take advantage of that by playing to being able to be more nimble in the market. And then Longfellow also maintains their duration within plus or minus 10% of our benchmark. Longfellow is smaller, and they have 40 employees with 20 investment professionals, and they are at $11 billion in assets under management. John, can you go to the next slide, please? All right, so I want to note here that since we just funded Longfellow, all of the performance and risk metrics are from the composite. But we do expect similar performance with IRM relative to the benchmark, given their strategy is to be a little bit more overweight to the spread sectors. So like IRM, we would expect longer-term outperformance, especially in markets that are rallying, and then modest underperformance in risk-off markets. This was seen in 2020 as they underperformed the U.S. ag benchmark by 164 basis points in the drawdown, but they outperformed in the recovery by 162 basis points. John, can we go to the next slide? So our next manager is Brandywine. They are our global bond allocation. Similar to Longfellow, except they will also invest globally in investment grade rated bonds. And in doing so, they use currency management to manage currencies from global investments. So I think Kent mentioned this earlier, but we've been having discussions about the global bond allocation. Staff and Makita have spoken extensively. We do believe Brandywine is a good manager, but we're concerned about the allocation of global bonds as a whole. Brandywine has a they have a value philosophy, and they focus on real yields. So with this, they do not invest in any negative yielding bonds. So a lot of the European countries have been screened out. They have a macroeconomic investment style, so very top down. They're benchmark agnostic, so we do expect higher standard deviations from these guys. And Brandywine's goal is to beat the global ag, the benchmark, by 1.5% net over a full market cycle. John, can we go to the next slide? So with Brandywine, we expect them to outperform in neutral markets and rallying markets and underperform in periods of global bond market distress. Performance has not followed the expectations. Global bonds have rallied in the past couple of years due to lower and lower rates. However, Brandywine has underperformed. You can see this in the three-year excess returns in the top left. They have underperformed annually 1.16% for the last 3 years. A lot of this is due to the fact that they do not have any exposure to negative yielding bonds, where those yields in those countries have those interest rates have continued to get lower and more negative. And they have a underweight to the U.S. dollar based off of a relative purchase power parity model that states that the dollar should weaken and come back with mean reversion. However, in the past couple of years, the dollar has just continued to get stronger and stronger. In 2020, we did see significant underperformance in Q1, which we would expect that, given the stress in the market. However, you can see that Brandywine in our top right chart, the max drawdown, in March, they were down 10.6%, whereas the benchmark is only down 32 basis points. A lot of that was attributed to this flight to safety, which led to a spike and a rally in the U.S. dollar. Brandywine has rebounded and made up some ground in the recovery in 2020. Basically, a lot of the detractors in Q1 reversed course and started to outperform. A lot of that is attributed to their overweight and EM debt, the underweight to the U.S. dollar, and then they also shifted the majority of their U.S. treasuries to U.S. corporates in March and April of this year. One thing I would like to note is that the attribution for returns for Brandywine over recent years has shifted from the majority of it coming from bonds, and now the majority of the attribution comes from their currency management. John, can we go to the next slide? So our next manager here is Loomis Sayles High Yield. And so basically, this allocation invests in below investment grade rated bonds, so they will have typically higher yields and more credit risk than the previous managers we've been talking about. This investment is full discretion in the sleeve of investment products that Loomis has, which means it has very loose constraints, and they are allowed to go 50% out of the benchmark in this strategy, which you know results in the possibility for higher returns if the manager is able to produce alpha, but it also means possible higher volatility. I think Kent mentioned this earlier that we have been doing a lot of work on Loomis and deciding if stick with this product or to go to another one within Loomis, and we'll have something more in depth on that in November. But to kind of go in some detail on that, in 2019, the portfolio went through some turmoil. It's kind of, due to the out of benchmark, full discretion strategy that they had. So Loomis has a deep value philosophy and they'll overweight and lower rated credit. And in 2019, they decided to the overweight and lower rated energy credits and then barbell that with, being overweight and cash and short-term treasury, which did not really help performance a lot, which we'll go into in the next slide. But a key point here is that in April 2019, Dan Fuss, who was our longtime portfolio manager, when this was initially invested in back in 1998, he backed off from portfolio management responsibilities, and Matt Egan and Elaine Stokes, who are longtime Loomis High Yield portfolio managers, took over portfolio management responsibilities on our account. We've had calls with them, monthly calls with them since September 2019. They've been very transparent. We're happy with the positioning that they've gotten us into since they've taken over the portfolio, and we have gained conviction with the new portfolio management. John, can you go to the next slide, please? And so with Loomis, we do expect them to underperform in down markets, outperform in recovery, really due to their deep value strategy where they buy into weakness. You know, we expect to have higher volatility than the benchmark. Do this opportunistic approach, which you can definitely see in the top right chart. Standard deviation is pretty high. As I mentioned, performance detracted recently. It has not followed our expectations. You can see there's underperformance in the 1, 3, and 5 year. See the negative excess returns there in the top left. Again, that was due to that barbell strategy that they had. For example, in 2019, the underperformance was we returned 9% in a rallying market where the index returned 12.6. We would expect Loomis to beat the market in a rallying market. However, the strategy wasn't working because of that overweight to the lower rated energy credits. Because in 2019, the high yield market favored double B, so higher quality bonds versus lower rated triple Bs, and energy names got hurt pretty badly there. So as I mentioned, the new portfolio manager, Matt Delane, came in, and they have closely aligned us with a composite. They started to do this in Q3 of 19 and continued into Q1 of 20. They were able to take advantage of some turmoil in the Middle East to get us out of some of these energy names at a decent valuation. And then during the drawdown in Q1, they were able to deploy most of that cash that was sitting on hand. We are impressed with what they've done. The 2020 performance, they outperformed in the drawdown and the recovery, which we're impressed with. However, we note that the energy credits that we hold still continue to detract from performance. John, can we go to the next slide? So our next manager is Pacific Asset Management. They are our bank loan managers. So like our high yield investment, Pacific Asset Bank Loans invest in low investment grade rated bank loans. The big difference here is that the loans here are they have floating rate coupons. So it basically means that, you know, when rates rise and go down, the coupons are reset based off of that. So the duration here will be very minimal versus all the other asset classes, and a big difference between that and the high yield. But like I mentioned before, Pacific is now our sole bank loan manager with $79 million. Due to the shift that we made from Loomis Bank loans earlier, which benefited overall performance for the year. Pacific is a conservative bank loan manager. They target the largest U.S. bank loans and the most liquid U.S. bank loans. Being more conservative means that they will have a lower yield than the benchmark, but they will have higher quality loans for the benchmark. John, can we go to the next slide, please? So given that they are higher in quality and more conservative, we would expect them to perform in down markets and underperform in rallying markets. Definitely saw this in 2020. They outperformed in Q1 and protected really well on the downside. However, they have lagged in the recovery due to being more conservative. So everything here is as expected. John, can you go to the next slide, please? And so our last manager here, Ashmore, They are our emerging market debt manager. So basically, they invest in debt from emerging market companies. So Ashmore's had some problems recently, which we'll get into on the next slide. But to note that they only make up 1% of the entire GPSP portfolio at $20 million. Ashmore, the strategy invests in EM external debt, which is based in U.S. dollars, local currency debt, which is based in the local currency of that country, corporate debt in the EM market, and then they invest in currencies to hedge and manage currency risk. A lot of the strategy is top-down, but they take advantage of some value-driven bottom-up work to exploit a lack of quality information in the EM market. They believe that they have an advantage here because the whole firm is solely dedicated in the markets, and they believe that they have boots on the ground in these countries that give them better information that should allow them to generate alpha. Ashmore is $84 billion in assets, and that's all focused in the emerging markets, either in emerging markets debt or emerging market equity. John, do you want the next slide? So, you know, with Ashmore, we do expect them to underperform in drawdowns and outperform in recoveries and rallies. This is due mostly to their value styling of buying into weakness when the market dislocation is the greatest. So the performance has been challenged, I would say, recently, the past couple of years. You know, for example, in 2019, they underperformed by 146 basis points. This is mostly due to a very disappointing Q3 last year with poor country selection issues. Mainly, specifically, it was in Argentina and Venezuela, both of which experienced some large political distress. Venezuela is in default, and the market is pretty illiquid, so we're waiting on restructuring of those bonds there. And Argentina had some issues with an election, and the bond got undervalued in Ashmore's opinion. And they, at that point, they were holding Argentina and added modestly when they believed the market was going to stabilize with a along with political stability, which is consistent with their philosophy and what we expect them to do. Unfortunately for them, you know, COVID happened in Q1 of this year, and some of these names that they were overweight, especially in South America, Argentina, Ecuador, and Brazil, and then also Lebanon, got hit pretty hardly. They got hit pretty hard by COVID, and the portfolio underperformed by 962 basis points. You can see that the max drawdown in the top right in March 2020, Ashmore was at about 21.5% drawdown, and the benchmark was at 12.7. So very disappointing there. But on the bright side, Ashmore didn't sell any of the positions. They followed their value philosophy and held on and added modestly to some of these harder hit positions during the downturn in the early parts of the recovery. And they were able to make up 827 basis points of outperformance in Q2 and Q3. So we would expect, since EM markets are, you know, have not recovered as swiftly as the U.S., we would expect continued outperformance if EM markets can continue to either be stable or continue to rally. But we are keeping an eye on them given the challenging performance we've seen the last couple of years. As far as the entire portfolio, kind of DPFP fixed income portfolio as a whole, I just want to summarize that I think, our building blocks are in place for the portfolio. The asset allocations are all there. There are a couple of investments that we're working to get up to target, like I mentioned. And then we're continuing to work on and improve some of these troubled managers in the credit space, which I alluded to earlier, we'll be talking about more in depth at the next board meeting. And then I believe we have a fee slide. I'm pretty sure it's probably in closing session. I don't know. John, can you go to the next slide? I'm pretty sure it's not there. It's probably in the closed session. Yeah. We have a fee slide. It's in closed session materials that you can look at. But we are monitoring fees closely and making sure that we got an MFN with all the managers. I won't speak more about that, but the information is in the closed session materials. If you have any questions, you can reach out to us about that.
How often do you meet with the managers normally in a non-COVID environment? I mean, is it a quarterly or annual meeting with them, and where do you do that?
Yeah, I mentioned for Loomis, we've been meeting monthly, but for managers that are not, that we don't have concern over, that we're not keeping on the watch list or something, we meet with them quarterly. I've been meeting with everybody quarterly through the phone, and usually, when it's not COVID, they will come down here, once a year to meet with us face-to-face.
Okay. I mean, we are fortunate to have a resident fixed income expert on the board in Gilbert. So, Gilbert, could you just get any overview you'd like to add to this?
Sure. Thank you. First of all, the staff's done a real good job, right, in the presentation. All the managers we have are good managers. So I think everyone should feel comfortable about that. And Makita has scrubbed them all even way before we hired them. Income Research is one of the best in the business. Longfellow is a very good firm as well. I'm very happy. That's a woman-owned firm. There were about three or four diverse firms that were in that search. They won on their merit, but they are about 60% or so women-owned. I think we're getting our hands around Loomis, so I'm not too concerned. I think on the Brandywine, some of the trimming and so forth isn't related to performance. It's really just related to where we view rates worldwide and where we think they'll probably be going over the next year to 3 years. And for those that are really not in the market all the time, if there's really one number to sort of follow, it's the information ratio, which I don't recall which page that was here, which is just your active return divided by the variability of that active return. So that's really essentially telling you, are they making money for the risk they're taking? And I wouldn't focus on the short-term information ratio because they're all negative. And the reason is, and I wouldn't be so fixated on, they're negative here in the front numbers, just because of COVID and the extreme volatility we had in the first and second quarter, I think that's common. And some of those short-term struggles have led the 1, 3, and even some of the 5-year numbers to really drag. And that's perfectly normal, I think, for all of this activity. The 5-year information ratios, I think, are probably a better representation. And you'll notice.
Can you turn to slide 60? Slide 60, please.
Thank you, Kent. The thing about information ratio is just to give people a sense, an information ratio of about 0.50 or 50 basis points is very good. So just know that. A positive information ratio is certainly a must, but 50 basis points has been pretty good historically, so that's something you can look at. And I think if there's one number, that would be the one I would focus on. And my view is I wouldn't get so caught up on, they should do well here or there, or they're more value and this and that. And the reason is when we hire these managers, they have an assignment, and that assignment is to outperform the whatever the index is that the board chose, and that's the mission, and that's just what they have to do. And they've got to outperform net of fees because, remember, the net of fees is really the comparison because our alternative is to index. So I think our managers are all on the right track. I think watching Loomis is a good thing. It's not uncommon when you have a senior person, you know, retiring to have a few bumps in the road. But I appreciate all the hard work the staff is doing. I think we've gotten a good handle around it. So those are my comments really there, Bill.
Great. Thank you, Gilbert. Appreciate it. Anybody have any questions for Mike, Kent, or Gilbert?
I just have one when it comes to Brandywine. Did you say, Gilbert, you're not very concerned with Brandywine?
Well, no. What I said was some of the tweaking we're doing on the reduction of the assets isn't related to performance. It's related to where we see worldwide interest rates today and our expectation of where they're going. I think the staff is doing enough work to follow them, but the key is whether they had outperformed or underperformed, and of course they've underperformed, rates are unusually low and negative throughout most of the world, and our view is we expect that to start normalizing over the next couple of years. So that's the key.
Yeah, I think I had heard Mike say that they got out of negative yielding fixed income, which is a logical thing, but those rates went
right.
Even more negative, and that was part of the underperformance. So, I mean, you can understand why you wouldn't want to invest in a negative yield.
That's right. And so the view is even if they had gotten that right, I mean, the whole point is looking at that as an asset allocation decision sector, we think there's really nothing – no good news ahead for that, as we think rates will normalize going forward.
Okay, good. Thank you. We'll move on. We got a private equity to do now, and also, Kelly, if you can do your executive director's report right after that so that we can then go into the closed session on the legal issues.
Ryan, is most of the private asset cash flow in open or closed, or is it a mix?
It's all an open session, and if there's any detailed questions, that we can go into close, but we typically don't.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks. For benefit of Ken and Michael, this is a set of reports that we've been doing quarterly since the beginning of 2018. Given our overallocation of private assets and our high level of monthly net benefit outflows, we've been taking kind of a forward look at net private asset cash inflows that we're expecting through year in 2023. And we're doing this to try to assist the board in asset allocation decisions, cash redeployment planning, and liquidity analysis. On slide 76 here, a couple caveats. And wanted to point out there's three additional documents that accompany this presentation. First being, we have a detailed asset-by-asset cash flow assumption build-out. We've talked a couple times today about the market value adjustments to the private assets. We have a detailed schedule there, and then we also have an appendix that if you're interested in learning more about any of the specific assumptions for a certain asset, that's detailed there. So a couple of caveats that I wanted to mention, we have a lot more clarity and visibility into planned sales on some of our natural resource and real estate investments where we have direct ownership. On the private equity portfolio, we have a little bit less, we have not a lot of control except for a few situations that we talked about earlier today. So often there, we're just kind of using a 2 to 4 year distribution schedule where we, say this fund at the end of life and we expect a third to come back over the next 3 years. So actual results, looking forward, are going to be a lot lumpier than these reports show because we're kind of smoothing everything out a little bit. The other caveat is just, with COVID and the market downturn and the volatility, there's even less visibility into kind of what's coming out of the portfolio and some of the in-process sales that we had planned for 2020 have been put on hold. Moving ahead to slide 77. This is the set of charts you'll see a couple times, working from left to right. The show is kind of starting in September of 16. We had $1.6 billion in private assets in the portfolio. The blue bar showed since then we've had about $1 billion in distribution to us. Orange bar showing $238 million in capital calls. And then we've had a market value increase of about $90 million to get to our current reported carrying value of $820 million. A reason we can kind of pick that September 16 date was that's when we really started with the drop run, liquidating our private asset portfolio in a controlled manner. On slide 78, it's the same data, just showing kind of what's occurred since the new board formation in 2017. A little over half of the distributions have occurred in the last 3 years. Moving ahead to slide 79. This is where we review activity that occurred in the private asset portfolio in Q3. We had $8.2 million in distributions come back, and $7 million of that was from the AEW-RCH portfolio in the real estate, and the rest of it was kind of more normal income across the portfolio. One thing to point out here, this is the second sizable distribution we've seen from RCH this year. So of the $31 million we've gotten back in 2020, over half of it has come from RCH. They're really been the driving force this year. Moving ahead to slide 80. This is kind of just a detailed look at what has happened by quarter since that September 2016 date, the blue bars being quarterly cash inflows from private assets and orange being the outflows. The three kind of higher amounts in Q4 16, Q1 17, and Q3 17 were a set of secondary sales we did in the private equity portfolio, and then the direct sale of our toll road holdings. So, just for Michael's benefit, Tim knows this, but you know, a lot of the low hanging fruit in the private equity portfolio has been picked, and we were sold what we could sell, and we're left with is either newer commitments, some real estate assets, or stuff that's a little bit harder to liquidate. So in 2020 so far, as I mentioned, we have had $31 million in distributions, which is down significantly from what we've seen in even the last couple of years. Our average per quarter was $37 million across 18 and 19. So we've seen quite a drop, as I mentioned earlier, with some of the sales activity going on hold. On 81, we've talked about it a few times today, but a little bit more detail on the market value adjustments that we're doing to the private asset portfolio. A lot of the values that have been reported to us are either based on kind of year-end 2019 values or statements we received in 2020 that haven't really been adjusted for market changes based on the downturn this year. Obviously, public markets have rebounded quite a bit, but we have considerable exposure to energy, private equity, retail, real estate, some sectors we feel have been hit a little bit harder than the overall market. So similar to the asset-by-asset projections, we're going asset-by-asset and applying a discount to the current carrying reported value if they haven't been updated so far in 2020. High level, our current percentage adjustment to the private market is 27.6%. Which brings us from $820 million down to $593 million. As we're getting kind of updated values in 2020, we are removing the adjustment. I expect next time you see this at the November board meeting or the next time we do this set of presentations, that percentage adjustment will be quite a bit less because even in the last couple of days with HOP being received and some updated valuations we got for Q3 in the real estate portfolio, we're starting to see more kind of real-time valuations on the portfolio. So the other high-level point is just our three big exposures, AEW, HOP, and Lone Star, make up $354 million of that $395 million in value. So over 60% of those three investments. So really, in order to get to the sizable cash flow coming back, that's what's going to move the needle. Moving on to 82, same chart we've looked at a couple of times, but just adding in that market value adjustment based on what we just talked about that gets us from 820 down to the 593 million. So the rest of the charts in this presentation are going to be based on that 593 estimated current NAV. On 83, this is really where we bring in kind of our forward expectations using our modeling. The gray dotted line at the top is kind of what we had projected a year ago this month as far as what would happen going forward. Obviously, just based on even the activity in 2019, sales were not occurring as quickly as we had projected, and then plus the impacts of kind of pushing everything out a year due to COVID. You can see those two lines, the dash blue and the dash orange, have been kind of pushed out a few quarters. The dash blue line is kind of what we would expect if values recover to the reported NAV, and the orange line is the adjusted downward NAV. On a go-forward basis, we have pretty good visibility into a few planned real estate sales that should occur in early 2021. And we've got some good news on that yesterday as well. So we expect, you know, upwards of $60 million of planned sales that we have a pretty good visibility into. But beyond that, as I said, it's kind of talking to the managers and getting best estimates on when things are going to sell. And if not that, kind of a smooth, we expect sales to occur over 3 years. The only quarterly changes that we made this time were adding in that some of the funding for the private equity portfolio that we just approved, and then with that set of funds, pushing out the sales from the actual fund a year. So we're assuming we get repaid on some of the new funding going in within a year, but the broader sales from the portfolio don't occur. We don't see distributions from those until 2021. Other than that, we pushed a few real estate sales back a quarter since we only have one quarter left in 2020. And we're assuming that all the unfunded capital across the private equity portfolio gets called, and it's not a huge amount, less than $7 million, I think. But we've kind of just pushed some of that into 2021, too, since we haven't seen that get called as quickly in reality. And most likely not all of that will get called anyway. So on 84, John, this is kind of what we look at each year end, our expected exposure to private assets and broken down by legacy and non-legacy. As a reminder, legacy refers to the carrier, higher risk, tail end assets. From an actuarial perspective, we're applying zero to return to these assets. They're in the detailed schedule on the additional confidential materials, they're highlighted in yellow for so you guys can see kind of what goes into that category. At the end of 2023, we expect to have about 110 remaining in the portfolio. So with the ag portfolio, it's a long-term hold that makes up a good chunk of that amount. And then finally on 85, this just showed the percentage allocation to private markets. Currently, we sit at 33.5 with it based on the market value adjusted NAV. In order to get to our long-term target or below our long-term target of 15, you know, we need to see pretty sizable sales over the next few years, and we would kind of drop below that threshold sometime in 2022. So any questions on these reports or any of the projections going into it?
Okay, I'm hearing none. Kelly, do you want to complete the issue with the executive director's report?
Yes. So on the executive director's report, the update to the open records request is we've only received one research type request since the last board meeting, and that has been completed and received no other requests, just that one. And then as far as COVID goes, we haven't made any changes related to the staff response to COVID. People are still working remotely. It seems to be working well. I guess the only change we did make is we have opened it up for staff members to go back to work if they find that they want to do that or they're more productive to do that with their supervisor's approval. So that's really the only change. We're just kind of playing it week by week just to see what's going on in the environment around us. I'm not sure when we will be going back at this point. That's kind of the status. Are there any questions about either of those items or concerns?
Okay. I guess everybody's getting a little tired. We're getting close to noon here, so we'll try to wrap up. Okay, we'll go back into closed session. I believe, Josh, you've got one or two legal issues you've got to review. I guess we'll just come back into open session briefly if we have a motion to enact or to act on. Otherwise, we're going to adjourn the meeting and go into the supplemental meeting. So there's not a lot of meat or substance that I think will be covered, but if people want to hang on, that's up to them. So let's go to closed session at this point, John.